Hello, this is Profiles. My name is Peter Jacoby, and our guest in the studio today is Marietta Simpson, a musician, a mezzo-soprano, an artist of wide-ranging gifts. She's now a sought-after teacher of young singers at Indiana University's Jacobs School of Music. And as performer, Marietta Simpson remains comfortable in opera, concert, recital, as interpreter of the lead, spirituals, songs of faith, even as jazz stylist, a la Sarah Vaughan, Billie Holiday, and Nina Simone, which she's to accomplish in a concert scheduled right around the time that we're doing this program. Marietta, you're at the top of your vocal game. Unlike other singers who turn to teaching when their time in the spotlight is just about up, why have you joined teaching at this particular time?
That's a very good question, one that I've asked myself quite a bit. But I think the main reason is that I think you come to a point in your life when you start thinking about what you want to accomplish and what do you want to leave as a legacy for your life. And one of the things that I've been really blessed to have is lots of people who have planted seeds in my life and who have given very freely of themselves to help make me the musician that I have become. And I wanted to be able to do that for young people. And it seemed as though this would be the time to do that while I'm still singing and, you know, to help them understand some of the pitfalls of singing and the business and to be able to share that with them. And it's interesting because not only do I share something with them, but they also share something with me. So I feel like I've been really fortunate, and it seemed like a really good time to do that while I still had the energy to do that.
Yeah. And while you're still experiencing it,
exactly.
It seems closer to you, and you can bring it to their attention.
Exactly, exactly.
What are they contributing to you in the meantime?
In the meantime, there is such excitement and hope, and there's an energy that young people have that sometimes as you continue in this business, you can start to take things for granted and start to be a little jaded in how you view the business aspect of this. And when you're with these young people, they are full of dreams still. They're very excited about what life holds, and they have a new energy and outlook that they help you with. You know, it makes me realize once again why I do this.
You know? So they lift you up.
They definitely
and make
do.
You a more energetic performer.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Where did all this begin now? Let's go back a bit in your life to the roots and your family. There must have been music there.
There was music all the time in my family. I am the seventh out of eight children, and my parents were great classical music lovers, and we had one of the old wooden case stereo systems that was like a piece of furniture, and we listened to Robert Shaw and Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians when I was growing up, and, you know, Leontine Price recordings were in the house, and Al Hurt, and, you know, we had all types of music in the house. And then we all sang together. We were known as the Singing Simpsons. And when I was younger, my family went up and down the East Coast every
weekend.
Where
did all this happen?
In Philadelphia. We traveled every weekend. And that was kind of difficult with that many children. But we all jumped into the station wagon, and my brother and I and my sister, actually, the three youngest, were able to fit in the back of the station wagon in the little pull-down seat. But we did that for about 10 years, and until the older kids got so much older that their schedules in school and all that prevented my family from doing that. But when they first started out, I was actually too young to go with them. So, you know, we would sit on the couch and cry when they would leave because we wanted to be out there singing with them. The Singing Simpsons sang anthems and sang, you know, adaptations of different classically sacred pieces. And my parents both have very operatic voices. And I had two sisters. I had one of my late sisters actually played the piano until the sister who's right above me was about 10, and then she started playing the piano for the family. So they sang things like List the Cherubic Host by Mendelssohn and I Waited for the Lord by Mendelssohn. And people would give them songs to sing. So that's the kind of music that they did when I was growing up.
For what kind of audiences?
Church audiences, yes. In churches, always. You know, I remember this very distinctly from my childhood, that we went to a church in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And the first year that we went, it said 10 singing Negroes from Philadelphia out on the church board. And then the next year we went back, I guess fewer of us came, and it said 8 of Philadelphia's finest Negroes. But it was a great audience, you know, and back then life was life and things were like they were. So we didn't even take offense at that. We just thought, wow, that's really interesting. They have it right out there on the front of the church. But it was always a church audience. And, you know, and then my family also did recordings when I was young. So they went all over and we saw all types of people and had all kinds of performing experiences as a family back then.
Did other brothers and sisters continue in music?
Yes. One of my late sisters was a classical singer. She actually won the Naumburg competition and went to Juilliard. And I remember when she was going off to school, there was a big discussion as to whether or not my parents were going to let her go to New York by herself. Because, you know, New York was Sin City, and my father was not happy about that at all. But, of course, they let her go. And the irony in that story is that when she went to Juilliard, she studied with Marion Freshel. And years before, my mother had wanted to take voice lessons. And she went to a renowned teacher, but the teacher charged at the time $25. And my mother could not afford that. And so the teacher said, send me one of your daughters then. And when my sister went to Juilliard, it was that same teacher, mm-hmm. Marion Freshel, that she mm-hmm. studied with.
Now, who did you study with?
I studied with Carmen Savoca and Peyton Hibbett in Binghamton, New York, in the Tri-Cities Opera Company. Those were my first teachers.
So you studied with professionals outside of a school situation?
I actually came to studying late. I took some lessons in high school, but that I was not ready psychologically to take voice lessons. And part of that was my older sister was so renowned in Philadelphia. I needed my own reputation. I needed my own foothold in the musical world, and I did not want it to be in her shadow. And so I took up the trombone during my younger years, and so I didn't really take that seriously. So I didn't ever really consider myself having studied, because I took maybe one or two lessons back then. But it was when I went to graduate school that I switched over to voice, and Carmen and Peyton were my teachers at that time.
And graduate school was in Binghamton?
It was in Binghamton, New York, yes.
What did you learn from those early experiences with the Singing Simpsons?
I learned how you could fight in the car and get up and sing like nothing had happened. And I also learned that in a broader sort of way that singing really is about touching people and communicating, and it's more than the notes. It's about a soul and a heart and bringing that to the music making. And also that in whatever situation you're in, if you're going to go on stage, then you need to bring the best you have right then. And you have to learn to put aside whatever is happening in your personal life to go out on stage and deliver the best performance that you can. And I learned that time and time again from watching how my family came through personal adversities to walk out on stage and really communicate and really commit to a performance. And then when you come off stage, all those things are still waiting for you, but you don't bring them out to the audience. And I learned that very early on.
Well, a certain spirituality seems to come out of you when you sing. I've heard you. And I know you've chosen some selections for our program today, which deal with spiritual
yes.
matters. And let's try one of those. You have chosen a selection from Dvorak's Stabat Mater. So
yes.
tell us about that, if
well,
you wouldn't.
I would be happy to. I chose this selection because this was the last piece that I recorded with Robert Shaw. And this is the Inflammatus movement for the alto soloist and the orchestra. I was so moved doing this recording because Mr. Shaw had done so many pieces so many times. And this was actually the first time he had done the Dvorak Stabat Mater. And so he was very excited about the piece. And he brought an intense energy and an intense feelings, emotional feelings about having the opportunity to record this piece. And so I felt really honored to be a part of the recording process.
Was this when he was in Atlanta?
Yes. This was at the end of his tenure in Atlanta.
Okay. Well, then let's listen to the Inflammatus. Marietta Simpson is the mezzo that you will hear. She is our guest in the studio today. We have heard the Inflammatus from Antonín Dvořák's Stabat Mater, a recording that Marietta Simpson made with Robert Shaw and his chorale and the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. Marietta, is that kind of music the favorite of all the different types that you do, or do you think that whatever you're doing at the moment is your favorite?
I have to say that is what my answer has always been, because people always ask, what's your favorite piece?
Yeah.
And it really is the one that I'm working on at the moment. It really is.
So when you deal with something like the Stabat Mater, talk a little bit about how you prepare for it.
Because I've spent a majority of my professional life doing oratorios, I try to compare it and contrast and compare this Inflammatus to other Inflammatus that I've heard, and look for ways that within the style of the composer and the time period that the music is written, that you can be expressive of the text. This particular piece tends to be a little more difficult because it's heavier. The orchestration is heavier. And it's so thick, and how to do that without becoming the typically woofy mezzo-soprano that sounds like a caricature of oneself is the challenge in this piece. And so I started working on this much in the same way that I work on other pieces, that first I look at the text and then try to dissect the text and then go to the music. Because if I start with the music first, often it's like eating dessert first for me. Mm. And I don't want to get into the tedious work of really examining the text. So that's how I approach this piece.
But that's, of course, how you can understand the music better too, isn't it?
Much better. Much better. Because sometimes if you listen to the music first, you'll go on the character of the music and not on the character of what you're actually, the essence of what you're really saying. And that will totally reframe how you perform a piece.
And that would stand you in good stead when you're doing opera, for instance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You must always look at the story first and look at the libretto and understand the character and then go to the music.
Is there a type of music that is most difficult for you?
I think the most difficult thing for me is if the music doesn't speak to me. And that could be in any time period, really. I used to think there was something wrong with that. But then I've heard so many other performers say that they have to perform music that says something to them. And I totally understand that. If it doesn't speak to me, it's very difficult for me to tell a story to somebody else about it. It's more helpful if there's a one chord or a five chord or a two or a six. But with any composer, trying to understand their language is the key. And once you can understand a composer's language, then the music can speak to you in different ways.
But you have to be open to the music.
You totally have to.
Not every singer is equally open.
That's very true. That's very true.
Some of them deal primarily with technique and those kinds of abilities. But you seem to really throw yourself in.
I try to. I feel like there, what for me, and I can only speak for myself, there would be no other reason to do this if you did not allow yourself to throw yourself into it. And that approach, it means that sometimes it's not always perfect, you know. But I've come to terms with that, that I'm okay with that. I want to do the best job that I can technically, and that's why you spend so much time studying and coaching and working and examining things. But in the end, I think you really do have to throw yourself into it and commit to it. And that means everybody's not going to like it, you know, but that's okay. That really is all right. It doesn't matter what you do. If you're a fabulous technician, somebody's going to say, but it has no soul. And if you are totally emotional, somebody's going to say, you're totally emotional, but there's zero technique. And so trying to find a balance of those two things is for me the constant challenge.
To keep your vocal prowess up, how much time do you spend each day working at your voice?
Well, I would love to give you the perfect answer of yes, every day for 2 hours I'm singing. But I will say that in my youth, I was more prone to do that. Teaching presents a different challenge because trying to find not only the time is there, but the energy and the mental energy to keep practicing. That is what the challenge is. And so since I've been teaching, I've been really trying to find the balance for that. If I have a job coming up, then I really do like to spend at least an hour a day singing. That does not always happen. But that's the goal. That's definitely the goal.
How many professional assignments would you undertake now when you have a full-time teaching schedule?
The thing that I love about being here at Indiana is that this university, above many, if not all universities, honors performers. And they see the value of having a performing faculty. And so there is always the encouragement to continue doing what you do professionally for as long as you can do it, as often as you can do it, so that you can bring back that experience to your students. And so I am at a point now that I don't have to take every job that comes down the pike, and I can be more discriminating about which jobs I take. So I try to take the jobs that are meaningful to me. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to do that. So,
returning to spirituality, there's a very different kind that you deal with in Gustav Mahler, and you have selected something that you've recorded by him from the Kindertotenlieder.
Yes.
Tell us what you have selected from that wonderful cycle.
I have selected Wenn das Mütterlein, and I picked this because this was one of the first pieces that I remember listening to Dieskau sing, his recording of this. And I think I've always just been so I've been so aware of people being able to communicate a message. And I remember when I heard this, I was so blown away. I would sit and listen to this recording and just weep because I thought he did such a beautiful job of expressing the text and the emotion of the text, and the music so reflects that. There's such a wonderful harmony between the intention and the music, and I was so moved by his portrayal. And so when I got a chance to do this piece, you know, it's one of those full circle moments where I felt like, wow, maybe I am a musician that I get to do this. And so it's one of my favorite pieces. This whole song cycle, of course, is about the death of children. And this particular song, the father is saying that when the mother comes to the door, his first gaze is not to her, but it's to the spot by the door where the child used to stand. And he says that, you know, you who are my joy, too soon you're gone from this world.
And with whom are you doing
this? This is with the Prague Festival Orchestra. Richard Westerfield is conducting.
Ah. We've just heard one of the songs of Mahler from the cycle Kindertotenlieder, as sung by Marietta Simpson, our guest in the studio today. Yeah. Preparing for Mahler, he's got so much to say in his music, doesn't
Absolutely.
He?
Absolutely. It is a very, very, I don't want to say draining, but it is an emotionally intense experience preparing for Mahler. And one of the challenges for me is to not become so emotionally involved in the music that I can't sing. And so there is a point in time in working with students, one of the things you get to see quite a bit is that students don't want to go to that emotional place where they might cry or where they're not in complete control of the situation. And you understand that because there are grades writing, and on grades are writing futures and future scholarships and all that sort of thing. And what I like to tell them is that there is a time and a place that you must go there because you need to have that experience away from the performance. And once you've allowed yourself to have that and to become so emotionally tied and psychologically tied to the music, then you can step back. But if you never allow yourself to become fully absorbed in the music and in the text, that will not come in a performance. And if it does, it will normally come in a negative way because the enormity of the emotions can be overwhelming in a performance. And you don't want that. There are so many layers to Mahler that you really have to just take the time to peel back the layers. And what oftentimes you come, the impression, your initial impression of the music is often changed by the time you get to a performance because you get to see where the melodic lines, yes, there is that intense longing, but there is also intense joy in Mahler's music. And to find those things that are not inherently obvious when you start to approach the piece, that is one of the wonders, I think, of singing Mahler.
Are young singers, such as you have in your studio, emotionally and artistically ready to attempt something like that?
It depends. Not every young singer is, but I think there is there's almost a graduation to Mahler, you know. You start with Schubert, and you discover that in Schubert, and you learn how to dissect a Schubert song, and you move on to Brahms, and you move on to Wolf or Schumann, wherever that next step is along the way, and you graduate to Mahler. I don't think you start there.
Well, just as an opera, as your voice develops,
exactly.
You start with one set of composers and
exactly.
then move on.
Exactly. Not many people start with the Ring cycle. And people don't always think of that in terms
That's
of
right.
song literature, but it's true. It's absolutely true.
Your particular approach to music, which is from the text, from the meaning,
mm-hmm.
Must be important to your students or must become important to your students
yes.
and have an effect on how they approach their studies.
Yes, mm-hmm. I would like to think that it does. I think they get really tired of me harping on that. But if you're not saying something, what are you doing? If you're not trying to tell a story, what are you doing? And I think that one of the things I try to tell my students, because, of course, I didn't wake up, you know, knowing this. Somebody said this to me and had to plant that seed in my brain about what's important when you're performing. One of the first things that happens when you get nervous on stage is that you go to, what do I sound like? And if you focus totally on what you sound like, the level of nerves only increases. One of the things that helps when you're on stage, when you have nerves, and I don't know anybody who isn't nervous on some level.
Don't you have to be? Really
I believe so. Job. And if I've ever done anything when I wasn't nervous, that made me nervous because I thought, what's going on that you are not involved in this in the right way? One of the first things that you need to be able to do is to focus on something else other than yourself. And the thing you want to focus on is your intention. What am I saying? Who am I? Where am I? What is this story? And that really helps take you out of yourself so that you can give a believable and committed performance. But if your focus is only on your voice and is my A where I think it should be, that's a very hollow performance for not only you but for the audience.
Well, one of the forces that you certainly think about is your God.
Absolutely.
Your religion, your faith. And you have brought a hymn, recorded hymn, and we'd like to turn to that, I think, now. It's called Does Jesus Care? Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, a lot of people assume that when I grew up, I sang gospel music. And I didn't for the majority of my childhood because, as I said before, my parents were classical music lovers. And we sang in church, but at that time, most of the churches that we went to sang hymns. So when my family got together, we sang hymns all the time. And we would sing the Messiah together. And, you know, very unusual to have had that kind of upbringing. At the time, I thought it was totally usual, normal, and I thought everybody's family did that. So I grew up with hymns and came back to them. I mean, I always sang in church throughout my school days and my professional life. But one of the things that has always been near and dear to me is being able to sing a hymn and not in the way you sing them in church, in that, you know, everybody sings the two-bar phrase, takes a breath, and moves on with no real attention to the words. And I had an opportunity to go into the studio and record some hymns with my sister playing the piano. And so she's on the piano, and it's very touching to me because, you know, we used to wash dishes together, you know. And, you know, she's older now and a grandmother, and I'm older now and not a grandmother, thank God. You know, to have that kind of history with her and that kind of history with the music is very special to me. And so I chose this one.
Does Jesus care when my heart is pained too deeply for mirth or song? burdens press and the cares distress, and the way grows weary and long. Does Jesus care when I've tried and failed to resist some temptation strong? When for my deep grief I find no
Marietta Simpson and her sister at the piano doing Does Jesus Care, one of the hymns that our guest in the studio loves. In your biography, I see that you did Porgy and Bess.
Yes, yes.
In London.
Yes.
At Covent Garden.
Yes.
What role did you play? First
Mariah.
Time? Mariah.
Yes.
And what was that experience like?
Well, it's actually very interesting. When I started straight out of the Houston Opera Studio, the opera company Glyndebourne Opera Festival, came to Houston to do auditions for Porgy and Bess. And I remember auditioning for the part of Mariah, and I got the role. And I remember having to go to Philadelphia to ask my parents if it was okay if I did the part, because there was profanity in the part. And I knew that would be an issue. And so, you know, we talked about it. And eventually, as they always did after the talk, well, you go ahead, you know. And I did that part. And it was one of the most moving experiences that I've ever had in my life. Trevor Nunn was director. Simon Rattle was the conductor. An amazing cast of singers. Several former IU students were actually in the chorus and had small parts. And it was a transformative experience. To have a director and a conductor of that stature, bringing everything that they bring to other pieces, to Porgy and Bess, which has often been a piece that has not received the highest level of respect or given the highest production values. Here was a company,
world class
company, bringing all of their resources to this piece. It was an absolutely amazing experience. And so I had the opportunity to go and do it. I did it. And so many wonderful things and relationships came as a result of that performance. And that was a very long time ago, for me anyway. It's the lifetime of my daughter, because when I went to Glyndebourne that summer, I was pregnant. Mm. And my daughter is about to graduate from college, and I'm going to go back to Glyndebourne this summer to do a world premiere of another opera. So that, to me, is just such a fabulous kind of bookend experience.
And what opera is this?
It's called Of Love and Other Demons. It's an opera by Peter Oetvös, and it's based on the book of Gabriel
Garcia.
So that's what I'm going to be able to do.
Wow, that's an exciting.
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
Do you remember any other moments? Do any stand out
in the Porgy and Bess experience?
Between the Porgy and Bess.
Yeah, well, I do remember a couple. Had a couple of experiences in between there, you know. But with Porgy and Bess specifically, I got a phone call years ago. I decided that sometimes Porgy and Bess has been the sole operatic experience for a lot of African American singers, and with that has come a level of bitterness that they have not been accepted in other roles. And I never wanted to be that person. When I came to Porgy and Bess, I always wanted to come to it with joy. And so that meant that along the way, there were several productions that I was asked to participate in that I would not participate in, because I could see that they probably were not going to be the positive experience that I really wanted it to be. And so, but I did get a call from Houston years ago, and they asked if I would be willing to be a part of their production. And I had not been a part of their production prior to that. But when they made this call, they were going to La Scala, and they asked if I would come and do that. And of course, the answer was, let me check my schedule, yes. So
you were able to do it.
I was able to do that. And I was able to take my daughter with me, and one of my other sisters went as the caretaker for my daughter, and it was just a really fabulous experience. I have the picture of La Scala in my office now. I'm sure my students never pay attention to it, but it's a reminder to me, you know, that was really a great experience.
Our time is coming near an end, and we still want to hear from you one more time musically, but I wanted to ask you, What do you want your listener, your audience, to go away with when you have performed?
I want my listener to go away having been touched by the music. I want people's, and it sounds like I'm running for Miss America or, you know, Miss Universe, but I really do believe that music has the ability to elevate people's lives and to touch them in ways that words alone seldom can. And I want something that I say or something that I sing or something that they hear or feel in a performance that I do to make them know that there is good, there is life, and no matter what they're going through, there's always a brighter side to it. There's always something more. And I really want people's lives to be touched by what I do.
And obviously that is what music has meant to you too.
Totally.
Personally.
On a very personal level, music has always been there for me. And music has totally changed my life. And I've seen so much of the world and had experiences that I never imagined having as a result of music. And I'd really like to give that to someone else.
And that's what you're trying to instill into your students.
It's exactly what I'm trying to let my students see and discover in themselves. Because everybody's journey takes them different places. But I want them to be open to the journey and to understand that success may not be what you thought it was when you started out. But if you will allow yourself to stay open to experiences, you will find success in very meaningful and very self-sustaining and important ways that you never – it will come to you in ways you never imagined it coming to you.
Is that what you want out of anyone who studies with you, an openness?
Yes. Yes. I would rather have a singer with less talent who's open than someone who's brilliantly talented but very closed off. Because someone who's open, you can have discoveries with. Someone who's closed off, there's the constant struggle to try to bring them out of themselves, to have them have new experiences because they're closed. They feel like they either know it, they've done it, and they don't want to come out of that box. And you need someone who's willing to take a risk.
Well, you've taken risks, I know. As we finish, I'd like to have you sing Wade in the Water.
Wade in the Water, I had the chance to record with a very dear friend of mine, the late Moses Hogan. And we'd had mutual friends over the years, and finally we had a chance to work together. And I worked with Moses up until the time of his death. I just thought it was a wonderful arrangement when I heard it. His whole take on spirituals was so unique and fresh and new. And I was very happy to have the opportunity to work with him for so long and so closely. So I wanted to pay tribute to my dear friend Moses.
God's out on the trouble.
We've heard Wade in the Water, a spiritual that is dearly loved by our guest, Marietta Simpson. Marietta, I want to wish you well and to thank you for a wonderful hour of conversation. Our guest has been Marietta Simpson. This is Profiles, and for Profiles, this is Peter Jacoby.
The program you have just heard was recorded in February of 2008.
The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.